Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and we have a bonus episode for you today.
Yes.
It is an interview, which we talked about and you heard a little bit of in our Scotch episode. We got to go over to American Spirit Works, a local Atlanta distillery, and talk to some of the team over there.
Yeah, we talked to the head distiller, Justin Manglitz, and mysterious person who works there, I think in marketing, Chad Ralston. He was never quite up front, but I think it's marketing.
Yeah. I think that's very fitting for someone in marketing. Oh!
Oh!
Hate mail.
Oh, no, please don't do that.
Oh, no, that would be very sad.
No, I enjoyed some scotch on the New Year's Day.
Yeah?
I guess that's a new tradition I've adopted thanks to this show. So, yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah. I still haven't. No one's entered my apartment yet. Lauren's like, what are you talking about? Supposedly the first person that crosses your threshold of your door in the new year influences the rest of your year.
Oh, okay. I think it was my cat. Does that count?
What color fur? Which cat was it?
Gray cat.
Okay, that's good. Apparently a redhead is the worst that could happen to you.
Oh, right.
But my best friend has red hair, so.
Oh.
I know. Decisions. Anyway, it was once again one of those lovely interviews.
Sprawling and so fun and knowledgeable. They were. I mean.
Yeah, we were there and happy to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No one was sprawling during it. The conversation was sprawling and they were knowledgeable.
Yes. Yes, and we got to sample some of their fine product, Tire Fire, which, again, is a wonderful name.
Oh, yeah, for a Scotch-style whiskey. So, yeah, we hope that you enjoy it as much as we did, and we'll get right to it. I like to start interviews with the question, hi, who are you?
I'm Justin Manglitz. I'm the head distiller here at ASW Distillery. This is Chad Ralston.
And I'm Chad Ralston.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Yep. I can actually speak for myself. I'm Chad Ralston, and I'm the token millennial here.
Technically, I'm also a millennial. I was born in 1981.
He doesn't act like it, though.
I don't act like it, apparently.
Oh, we're that in-between generation. It's okay. Yeah. So what you guys were bottling today is a peated whiskey. Can we start with some basics? Like, we know what whiskey is, but what is peat and what is malt?
Absolutely. So really, starting with malt is the easiest place to begin from. So malt can be really any type of grain, but in this case, barley, that has been germinated by soaking it in warm water and letting it sit so that it sprouts, just like you would start a seed at home in your garden. And in that process, in the sprouting process, the complex starches in the grain simplify, and the bonds break, and they become simple starches. And the process creates a diastatic enzymes in the grain, which are capable of converting those starches into sugar if heated up to the right temperature for the right amount of time. So when you sprout that barley to malt it, or sprout anything to malt it, in order to make it shelf stable so that it can be stored for a period of time and used by brewery or distillery or whatever, you have to dry it out. Historically, that was obviously not done with natural gas. So in different places, they use different things. Wood would have been very common.
Lasers. What, lasers?
No. In Taiwan. Yes. That's what makes Kavalan different.
Right.
So in Ireland, where it was originally forested, they used wood traditionally. Scotland, even before the English cut down all the trees that were there, didn't have a lot of trees. They mainly used peat, which is essentially petrified mud from a bog. And when you burn that to create heat, obviously it's also creating smoke, and that in the process of using the heat to dry the barley, that smoke infiltrates the husk material of the barley and gives it the peaty, smoky flavor. Historically, because most malt was kilned, dried with wood, with something that smoked. A lot of beers 400,000 to 500,000 years ago would have been smoky. Whiskey didn't quite exist yet 1,000 years ago. It was on the edge. So smoke was a very common and I guess essential element of beverage alcohol for a lot of the history of beverage alcohol, especially grain-based beverage alcohol. So that's basically where the peat comes in, and this the different levels of smokiness in the malt are governed by the amount of peat, the type of peat that are used to smoke the grain. So what I'm using for the tire fire is a heavy peated malt, which is 45 ppm creosols. Creosols are basically the smoke molecule, smoke element, which is on the very high side of peat. So that would mimic, say, an Islay whiskey like Laphroaig or Lagavulin or Ardbeg, which is my favorite Islay whiskey. The Highland, and those whiskeys are traditionally made largely or completely from peated malt, whereas in the Highland region and to some degree in Speyside region of Scotland, they're using either lower phenol, lower ppm malts, or just a mixture of peated barley and unpeated barley to have a somewhat more subtle smoke quality, which I also enjoy largely. I think Chad does as well.
I do. So much so that my wife and I spent our honeymoon in Islay drinking cask strength Lagavulin, cask strength Laphroaig, cask strength Ardbeg at 9:30 a.m., which really sets the tone for the day. But today, this very day that we were bottling Tire Fire, is our 3-year anniversary. So it's kind of fitting. We'll be definitely opening and drinking a majority of that bottle tonight.
Well, we'll find out if it gives you a headache.
That's right.
Very quickly now. When we opened ASW Distillery, as a whiskey maker, I do like to experiment and make different things. And both Chad and Jim and Charlie are all big fans of Islay whiskeys with peaty malts. I like the smoke creosols. I like the peat creosols. I'm not a huge fan of the Band-Aid and rubber creosols portions. So when I started thinking about doing the Tire Fire project, we were in a meeting and I said, if we were talking about some new products, and I said, if I could make us a whiskey that tasted like straight up poison, should I do it? And the agreement was definitely. Should definitely do that. And I just kind of ran with it. And this malt, like I was saying, it's more or less specially brought in for me. Not many people are using the heavy peated malt. I do, however, cut it in a way when I distill it to pull out some of the most of the more rubbery compounds because I don't personally like them. And some people love them. I don't care for them. So I'm able to remove those towards the beginning of the run to get a very smoky, very peaty whiskey that doesn't have some of the phenols that turn people off. So hopefully make it, while super smoky, a little bit more approachable to a wider array of people at the same time. And the Tire Fire was just, I have to have something to write on the barrels when I make these whiskeys so I know what they are. And I had started calling it Tire Fire, and so I started writing on the barrels, and eventually Chad was just like, F it, let's call it Tire Fire. Bleep it, call it Tire Fire. And Chad makes all the labels that we do in-house for all these things, and that really has enabled me to do the experimentation, because if we were paying $20,000 to a designer and a brander to come up with these things, we couldn't do that. So because he was willing to do this more, he's running out of time now, but that's really enabled us to have cool, interesting things come out to kind of really prove our mettle and
hit a lot of the different whiskey styles.
Yeah, so whiskey is kind of strange. It's still very segmented. Like we still get people coming in that say, "Oh, I only like bourbon," and there are plenty of people that say, "I only drink Islay heavy peated whiskeys." But nobody goes to a restaurant and they're like, I only eat hamburgers. Bring me ribs. If you don't have ribs, I'm leaving. I only eat ribs. This was the same way that it was with beer 20 years ago. I only drink Miller Lite. And we're still in that realm with a lot of spirits consumers in the whiskey world. And we want to be able to offer a wide array and also expand people's horizons, just like the breweries, the craft breweries were doing 15 years ago, 10 years ago. Well, we want to try to lead people into expanding their horizons when it comes to spirits.
And that's what our tasting room is for.
You know?
We're here right in the heart of Atlanta and one of the biggest convention markets in the country. We get lots of tourists all throughout the year, and we have obviously a booming metro area of residents as well. And so we just see hundreds of people coming through here every week. And you'll have somebody who comes in saying, I really only drink bourbon, and they try, you know, maybe Americanic, which is a very nice kind of bridge into the single malt category because it's very bourbon-esque in that it was aged in a new charred oak barrel, so it has some nice vanillin characteristics. And it's helping broaden people's flavor profiles and taste horizons.
Or duality, especially, because it's 50% smoked malt, but it's wood smoked malt, so which manifests very differently than peat, and it's more of a more subtle kind of fruity cherry flavor. It's also a little bit more barrel heavy. So that has been, I've had a lot of people say, I mostly drink bourbon, but man, that duality. So, I mean, and then their next step can be whatever it is, whether it's a rye or tire fire, maybe not quite there yet, but we're working on it.
Small steps, yeah. Where do you guys get your malt, and where did they get the peat to smoke it?
This was made by Baird's, which is a Scottish malting company. They do not tell you where they get the peat. So,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Scotland, so, I would assume.
Yes, absolutely. It's a Scottish company, Scottish grown grain, Scottish harvested peat.
Is it just because they're parsimonious with words why they won't tell you? Or they...
They probably don't want to waste the ink writing an email.
That's exactly right. So there's a little bit of lore around the whiskey with an E and whiskey without an E spelling of whiskey. And the best explanation I've heard is that the Scottish label printers dropped the E hundreds of years ago because it wasted ink, and so they were being thrifty.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, so this Druid Hill, the triple pot still, which mimics an Irish-style pure pot still whiskey, the malt I use for that I get from a very, very small Irish family farm and malt company called Loughran's in County Lyle, and know the guy, James, and so there are things we use more that we have a little bit more information on, but with the heavy peated. They also make a super peated malt, but it's got shipping issues because they don't like to, they won't ship it in a container with other unpeated malts because it makes everything reek of peat reek. So I'm still pushing to do a higher tire fire, but we'll see.
Make the tire fire bigger. I love that. And what were you guys actually distilling today?
We're doing duality today. Yep. Yeah. So I generally make things in about 4-week blocks. The duality is 50. It's a double malt whiskey, which is just some crap I made up. It's 50% rye malt and 50% cherry smoke malt. In Scotland, they only recognize, because they're kind of grumpy, they only recognize barley. Malt made from barley as being malt, but you can actually malt almost any grain. So in America, we consider rye malt to be malt and wheat malt to be malt. So in Scotland, a double malt is generally a single malt from two different distilleries married together in
made
some proportion.
Made from 100% malted barley.
Right, made from 100% malted barley. So I basically just had the idea to combine, do exactly 50% rye malt and 50% barley malt based on the American definitions of malt and call that a double malt, which as far as I know, as far as we can tell, has not been done anywhere. Ferment and mash that all grain in and distill it grain in. So that's what we're doing today is the duality. And it, like I said, it's cherry smoke malt and rye malt.
And that was actually George's first ever double gold whiskey.
Yeah.
Double gold medal winning
this
whiskey.
This year it won a double gold at San Francisco, which is the main spirits competition, the one that truly matters. So yeah, that was good.
Yeah, congratulations. You were talking back by the stills about the Scottish method of just using the juice.
Right.
I'm using very technical terms.
The wash.
The wash, thank you.
Yep.
versus the bourbon method of having the mash in there, right, versus your method. Could you talk about how you arrived at that process?
when Charlie and Jim, when I first started working with them about 3 years before we opened the distillery, just to plan things out, they were really into rye and they wanted to make a rye whiskey, which is a difficult cooking and mashing process because it's got a lot of gluten in it. So it's very gummy and thick. So I said, hey, how about we do a rye malt whiskey, which I wasn't sure if it would have those same problems. I mostly make single malt from barleys prior. So I needed to test it and see if it would turn into a big gummy mess or if it would actually be pretty feasible to do. And when I tested it, I had one bag of rye malt and I had a part bag of barley malt or something. So I ended up doing it as 66% rye malt and 34% barley malt, which would be enough rye malt for me to test what would actually happen and taste it and know that the rye malt would be good. I had to build an agitator because I was going to do it grain in. I wanted to test the grain in fermentation and distillation as well. So I built an agitator for my wash still. So really after that, and it worked great, and it tasted awesome, and I called that a double malt, and I was like, well, why don't we just do that in the facility when we get it open as well? And Jim immediately, so this was 5 years ago at this point, he immediately said, oh, we'll call it Duality. So he came up with the name. It was, I guess, the second product that we had a concept for, and we hadn't necessarily planned to do it right away, but at the same time, I wanted to do it right away. So we did, and the using the cherry smoke in it was an idea that came later, just as an interesting, just I like smoky stuff, and you know, I think a lot of people like smoky stuff, and it's interesting. It's not the cheapest thing to do. It's actually the most expensive grain we use. It's about $1.10 a pound, versus rye is about 50 cents a pound. So it's more than twice as expensive as rye. If we wanted to make stuff cheap, we'd make everything out of corn, and then, you know, whatever. That's not what we do. Oh, so,
sure. So the method Justin has devised is basically combining the centuries-old method of copper pots that single malt distillers have been using with traditional 100% malted barley single malts. So he combines that, but he wanted to put the grains in there like bourbon distillers have been doing for, you know, however long now, where they leave the grain solids in there from mashing through fermentation into the distillation. So it's kind of combining both of those centuries-old methods to get the most flavor we can out of our system. And what that requires is he mentioned an agitator earlier. I don't know if you touched on this.
Yeah.
Or you did? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. But you can go on. You're doing a good job.
If you already discussed what an agitator is, I have Scottish ancestry, so I'm kind of parsimonious with words.
So if I'd gotten a Scottish, what Chad's getting at is if I'd gotten a Scottish still, they build them with steam coils inside generally, or cylinders, and that you can't put a mash in that because it'll scorch on that. They also usually use a rummager instead of an agitator. Although I love the Forsyth stills, the Scottish stills, they're beautiful. I needed kind of to combine on equipment level. I needed to kind of combine the Scottish and the American pot still. So the Scottish, so if you look at our stills, the top of them are like, look just like a Scottish. The wash still looks like a Glenfarclas head and the spirit still looks like a Glenmorangie head. At the bottom of them are Vendome. Over the years has developed stills that have a steam pan like I was showing y'all with an agitator rather than a full steam jacket. And as far as I know, they're the only people that built them like that for many, many years, pot stills. And so they kind of combine those things based on my needs.
Cool. Yep. What's your barrel process for the tire fire, and does it differ from what the traditional... I was reading that a lot of Scotch barreling is done in old, like, wine barrels, Madeira barrels, stuff
right,
like that.
Right, absolutely, yeah. So our barreling process is very different, partly based on laws. In America, when they made the laws, the regulations for what you could do with whiskey, the Cooper's industry was very powerful, and they wanted to make sure nobody was reusing barrels. So generally, in the U.S., we're required to age things in new white oak barrels, not in used barrels. Or if we want to use used barrels, we can't call it bourbon whiskey. We have to call it whiskey distilled from bourbon mash, all in the same size lettering, and it's not super feasible. Sometimes there's some exceptions to that. Duality, for example, they approved that to use both new and used barrels. A used barrel takes much longer to mature because it's already been heavily extracted. So we don't have 10 to 12 years anyway, because we would not be here in 10 to 12 years. We need to sell whiskey. So we're happy using new barrels. So the tire fire mostly, almost completely goes into new barrels. There's a few used that I've employed, but for the most part it goes in. So that's very different than Scott's made peated whiskeys, which are universally, for the most part, going into either ex-bourbon barrels or ex-sherry, sometimes port barrels. So what that allows me to do, so Chad touched on the flavor draw that I'm getting by having the solids in through the whole process. The historical reason to not do that was that people thought that it would pull tannins into the spirit from the grain. So that was part of what my experiment was to prove that that does not happen, that tannins do not distill over. I think I've adequately proved that now. Sometimes people just say things and it gets repeated and becomes, you know, the rule, and it's just not necessarily, you don't figure that out unless you do it and try it. So by having the grains through the entire process, I'm able to pull more malt flavor through the entire spirit run, whereas generally your flavor concentrates more heavily at the beginning and the end, and part of the art of distilling is in selecting how much of the heads, the beginning and the tails, the end of the second distillation to keep to put into a barrel. And to put it in a barrel and have it be good in 2 years, you have to take a fairly narrow cut, which is leaving out a lot of flavor. So what my process does is have more flavor through the whole thing. So I don't take super narrow cuts, conservative cuts, especially with tire fire, because a lot of the smoke still comes out, especially in the tails. But I can take slightly more discriminant portions of the whiskey to put into a barrel so that it doesn't really need 5-6 years to just be pretty good. It can be excellent in 18 months or 2 years in a new barrel, at least. Now, in a used barrel, that would still be pushed out, you know, at least a couple more years, just because there's not the extractive capability in the barrel anymore. That was a long explanation to say that the tire fire aging process, maturation process, is different both in the barrels that we're using and also in the amount of time that it takes because of my specific process and the way that I make the whiskey.
Cool.
So we have some more of this interview, but first we have a quick break for word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. Now let's get back into the interview.
Annie, do you have anything over there?
How did you get into this?
Well, I got interested in it I'm from Harrelson County, which is about an hour northwest of Atlanta. And my pawpaw had been a whiskey maker to some degree and also mainly, I think, more a driver. When he was a young man, that was my pawpaw Buck. And my granny really made him quit. She was a Baptist. And that, you know, I didn't learn anything from him. I just heard stories, mainly like from uncles talking while he was standing there not talking because he didn't want to get beat with something later, a rolling pin. Granny Ree always kept a jar of liquor in the cupboard for coughs. So like me and my cousin Josh would come in from hunting, like, oh, Granny, help us out. Get the jar out. I was interested in whiskey from a young age.
How did she have a cough?
She never fell for that. I never saw her drink it. She wouldn't even drink Coca-Cola because it burned her throat. She's going to haunt me for saying that. So I kind of got interested in it just based on family history. And then right out of high school, just decided to do it. And a friend's dad let me use his barn to just experiment, not extra legally. That doesn't mean very, very legal. It turns out, I thought it was very, very legal to make whiskey at home. Turns out extra legally means not legal. So that was not good. I wouldn't call it whiskey. Whatever I was making was not very good, but it was okay enough to keep trying and experimenting. And I started, so this is about 2000. My dad started making wine with his Italian neighbor. It was really bad wine. So I kind of started helping them, and we started getting grapes shipped in from California, and I learned a lot about it. And then I started making beer, and then I opened a homebrew shop. The old homebrew shop that I worked at in Athens went out of business my last semester at college. So then I opened my own homebrew shop, which more or less was just a way to be able to make as much alcohol as I wanted, because it didn't make a lot of money. And I was part of the DIY punk scene in Athens, so that kind of went hand in hand. And then at some point early, maybe 2004, 2003, when I started making all grain beer, not from extract, I realized that I was making the basis of the whiskeys that I like to drink. And at that point I had come to like Scottish single malts. Around then I started trying to up my distilling game and figure out how to do it better. Distilling's not like brewing, where there's a codified and well-known methodology. I kind of learned through trial and error, poured out a lot of stuff, and just figured it out as I went, which is how, a lot of distillers figure it out, because, like I said, there's not one way to do it. Brewing has been the same for 100 years, since the Industrial Revolution, with very, very few changes. And distilling is still basically an individual pursuit. Bourbon may be all made the same way for the most part in Kentucky, but it's very different. Like, if you learn how to make bourbon in Kentucky, you cannot go make whiskey in Scotland or Taiwan or Japan or at ASW Distillery, because that's not how we make. It's just a very different process, very different equipment. So I basically taught myself how to do it, how to make good stuff. And started buying 5-gallon barrels and aging it. I never sold anything, or I wasn't that extra legal. I just was basically making it to learn how to do it and to drink it and share it.
And the batches that you poured out, is that a euphemism for saying you gave them to
punks?
Punks. Yes.
Poured it out into punk's mouth. And then I sold the brew shop, and a couple years later, started working with Jim and Charlie I went to high school with Jim's sister, Joy. She's been a pretty good friend of mine since middle school, I guess, when my family moved to Athens. And Jim went to high school with my sister, who's 5 years older than me, his age. And so Joy said, oh, you've got it. When they started American Spirit Whiskey and we're talking about opening a distillery, she said, oh, you've got to try my friend Justin's whiskey. It's really good. And they're like, yeah, sure, Joy, your friend Justin makes really good whiskey, I bet. So they asked me to, we talked on the phone once, and then I drove to Atlanta, my first time in Atlanta. Not a big city person. I get confused by roads. And I don't like phones, so I don't have the maps and stuff on my phone. I know how to get here. That's it. And I can get through Atlanta to go to Harrelson County. I do like Atlanta, though. I just can't navigate it because there's no creeks. Like, how do you know where you're at when you can't see a creek or a river anywhere?
The sun and the stars, dude.
Well, the sun's always occluded by smog. It's a very difficult place to navigate. Anyway, yeah, so I brought them a bottle, and they tasted it. It was actually the Americonic, basically exactly what's in the Americonic bottle. Same mash bill. They tasted it, and we went from there, and it took a long time, but we finally got this place running, and then they let me just kind of do what I want so far. Yep, and that's it.
How about you? How did you get into all this?
I was working at a software company in Midtown and loved to drink. So I was trying to build sales software for craft breweries, and all the ones that I talked to, not naming any names, said they really liked the concept, they just didn't have any money to pay for it. Which, in hindsight, I think means they didn't like the concept that much. They were just a little too nice to say it. And so in trying to find my first paying customer, I kept asking all sorts of different folks, you know, cheesemakers and winemakers, and ended up emailing Jim.
How different your life would be if the cheesemakers had taken you up.
I know, right? And Jim was intrigued enough by the concept to say, why don't you come sit down with me and we'll talk. And so this building that we're sitting in at the time was, it's the old Mason Muir Art Gallery. But at the time, Mason Muir, all of their art installations had been cleared out, and this was just a concrete shell. It was more or less like a bunker, right? And so the one piece of furniture in the whole building was, there's a supply closet on the total opposite end of the building. And so he and I sat in there and had a good conversation for about an hour, and they were about to raise money to afford this whole thing. And when he told me about, I assumed that meant in the next 6 weeks, not 6 months later. But so I wouldn't say I was hoodwinked into joining for basically peanuts for the first 6 months, but it borders on that, I would say. And so Justin had joined, and so he and I met for the first time at an event here.
The first time I came in this building, it was still the art gallery, and there was still pictures on the wall, and the Mason Muir was here, and he was like, who the f*** are y'all? And we were like, oh, we're stealing your facility. And he was like, it was a very big deal.
We did not acquire this by theft.
I'm sorry, that was, you can just, yeah. It was so legal, y'all.
Extra legal. Very, very legal. So that's, and then joined the team, and off to the races ever since.
Mm-hmm. It's been a race, that's for sure.
Sure has. I'm winded.
Do y'all do any collaboration with other makers of cool stuff around town?
Yeah, I mean, we have the Monday Night Whiskey. That was a mash that Peter and Adam made over, or washed. They made over there and fermented over there. Then brought to me and I distilled it. So we're on our second, I think I made 9 or 10 barrels of that the first year, and now we're on our second making of that, which I think we have maybe 18 or 20 barrels more. So that's been a pretty big collaboration. And then one thing that helps us stay alive is that because of the boom in barrel use by breweries, we're able to actually sell our barrels for not too much less than we pay for them. We're actually adding value to them. Whereas 10 years ago, you just kind of like, you got $50 for them, you were lucky if you could. You can shake them down and send them to Scotland and get about that much. So now we're able to recoup a lot of that, which is a huge expense for us, that just the barrels are about $200 a piece. So we do a lot of collaborations on that front. All the breweries are so pushed for volume right now, they don't have the fermenter space or the person power to really devote to more elaborate collaborations like we did with Monday Night, although we have tried to, we want to, and lots of them want to. It's just figuring it out it's hard. But the barrel programs have been good, and we do kind of, what do y'all call it, the draft and dram combo where, yeah, we kind of pair a whiskey with a beer that mainly Chad and Josh think would go well together. Orpheus has done one. I think we're doing another somewhere.
Yeah, we've got one down in South Georgia with Pretoria Fields,
mm-hmm, which is an old brewer from Russian River out in California. There's a pretty, what would you call it, beer of lore called Pliny the Elder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's Russian River. One of their brewers has started a brewery in Albany, Georgia, of all places. And so we've got a little draft and dram combo with them. Their brewery is called Pretoria Fields. We pair it with our Fiddler bourbon. We call it Fiddlin' in the Fields is the combo.
Yeah, and we have some other small projects in work. But for the most part, we're kind of hunkered down just trying to keep up with demand. So just we're kind of in the same boat as the breweries. We've tried to work with a winery to try to do some wine-finished whiskeys, but haven't quite made that happen yet. But yeah, we're looking to do some more collaborations. And Chad, like I said, his job is not making labels. it was not part of his actual purview. So we're all pretty pushed for what we can get done. But we got to do some more collaborations, and we know that.
Word to the wise for any listeners, if you don't know how to make labels, don't try to teach yourself. It's it's really, really miserable.
The payoff's been pretty huge, though.
It takes hundreds of hours. Don't do it.
There is even more interview for you, but first, there's one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
How much are you guys producing? How much did you start producing versus...
So we started production here. I was making two mashes a week in one day and then distilling that in 2 days over the course of 2 days. So we were making four barrels a week for the first year. And then we doubled that. We added some fermenters. And then Drake, my friend, who started brewing at my brew shop that I had and then went on to work at Stone out west and all some other breweries. He came on board in January so that we could, he makes four mashes a week and I distill four mashes a week. So now we're up to eight barrels, which is about 400 barrels a year. And that is close to full production.
That might not sound like a lot, but there are about 300 or so bottles per barrel. So it's a boatload of bottles.
We're the largest distillery in Georgia, but you know, a big factory in Kentucky is making 300 barrels in a week. So we're very small comparatively.
Why did the distillery set up in Georgia and Atlanta specifically?
Well, Jim and Charlie both live in Atlanta and love Atlanta. Atlanta is awesome, has a great spirits culture, cocktail culture, and other parts of Georgia do as well. It has not been served by a local whiskey distillery yet until us. So, I think it was more because they are Atlantans, as is Chad, than anything else. I mean, it's their town. Yeah, and they love it, and I mean, we all love it. But it doesn't hurt that there was not someone else doing it already. Like, Nashville's got two or three, and it's smaller than Atlanta, and there was no whiskey distillery here, so someone was going to do it. We just did it and did it really well.
One more process question. How do you pick out your grains and your yeasts for the different things that you do? Do you use the same yeast for everything? Or?
We use a couple different yeasts. I use a distiller's active dry yeast, which is a very basic yeast for some things, and then I use a whiskey yeast, which is basically bourbon yeast, for some things, and some things have both. Duality and Resurgence both actually use both yeasts. I found that to be more complex. We use a Sauvignon Blanc yeast for the apple brandy, but that's basically it. We don't do a lot of yeast experimentation because the way that yeast works is that the constituent flavors that are produced in the distillate from the yeast break down over time, and so I don't really know what the difference the yeast is going to do. I might not know that for 3 years, or minimum 2 years, or you know, three or four more likely. So if I change to a different yeast and I end up not liking it, I have just used it for 3 years. So with grain, I can do a lot of grain experimentation, and it's much more immediately evident what has happened. And how it's going to age. And I can tell, and you know, this first batch of Tire Fire was basically a test batch, and I knew after 3 months I could taste, this is awesome, we're going to do this, put it into our regular product lineup. If I had done it with a completely different yeast, then I may still not know. So we don't use a lot of different yeast. A lot of breweries don't now either. When I was learning in the brewing world, a lot of breweries did have a lot of different strains they used, and now it's gone to more house strains just for ease, and they may have a few different things they use and maybe a sour program. But for the most part, that's kind of simplified throughout the industry. And then with grains, as far as choosing, I just kind of think about it and make it up. because I owned a homebrew shop, I know all the grains that are out there. I certainly don't know all the hops that are out there now because they keep inventing new hops, keep breeding new hops every 2 months. But for grains, I've spent 15 years with them, and I know what they all do in beer and whiskey both. So, you know, I basically just figure out what I want to do in my mind and then do it. Yeah. You know, you still have to test it, and we do all our testing is in full. The least I can make is 3 barrels, so I have to kind of be pretty sure it's going to be good before I do something. So far, I haven't messed up, except we did put a barrel of Resurgence. We moved into a sherry barrel, and that is not good.
It's gross.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
So that will probably never be released. I keep putting it on our projected bottlings, like, oh, yeah, we'll release that next year. And then we taste it, and we're like, no.
Still not.
People never ask us, you know, are you going to have something aged 25 years? I'm like, see that barrel right there?
Resurgence that'll be sherry finish.
100 like, years.
There's going to be 3 bottles. Yep. But the Resurgence port finish came out great. So, yeah, we'll probably do that again.
Anything you have on the horizon that you're excited about? Any new things, projects?
So we have the Druid Hill, which is after many, many attempts at naming our Irish style, our pure pot still style whiskey. That is what was not taken, that we were not going to get sued for using. And I love the name anyway. But so we got that coming out in a couple weeks, and that will also be a permanent addition to the product line, although not for about 10 months, because that was also a test batch. And that's made from 30% unmalted barley in the pure pot still style. So in Ireland, the English made a tax 200 years ago or so on malt. So the Irish were like, well, let's see how much unmalted barley we can use and still make good whiskey. And it turns out it's about 30%. So they started doing that, and so I used 30% unmalted barley and then 70% from the Loughran's small family farm and maltster I was telling you about. And James will actually be here at the release of that here in a couple weeks. And that's also triple distilled, which is very cool and a lot of extra work. But it says triple distilled on it. Yep. And let's see what else. We have another. So Americonic is a series of single malts. And we have another of those coming out sometime, probably November. And then I think that's about it for this year. And then next year we have our pure pot still bourbon coming out in April or so. And probably some other single malts as well.
When you're calling these places that do these specialty malts and grains and stuff, have you ever had anyone go like, yeah, sure, I'll ship that to you. Wait, you're in where?
Yeah, I think so. I'm the, probably not explicitly, but imply, yeah, I'm actually the largest distillery customer for Country Malt, which is the main malt supplier east of the Mississippi, because not very many places are making malt whiskeys. They're mostly east of the Mississippi making bourbons for the most part. Out on the West Coast, that's not the case. California, Oregon, Washington have a lot of, and Texas as well has a couple of big malt whiskey makers, and Colorado as well. So, yeah, I think some people are surprised we're doing this in Georgia. It's kind of a big extreme step as far as going from no distilleries in Georgia, no whiskey distilleries in Georgia, essentially, to a pretty extreme experiment. You know, usually you'd have some kind of intermediary where you'd have just a basic bourbon distillery or something. And we make bourbon, but we kind of, and I think I kind of pushed us that way, as did Chad, just to be more craft. Just everybody's so jaded kind of by distilleries kind of doing the same thing over and over, that we wanted to really kind of flex our craft so that we could, you know, just show that we're real and doing real cool things, get people interested, and just interested in spirits. Because if you just make the same thing all the time, then people are not, it's only so excited you can get about a company that, a craft distillery that maybe crafts one thing or maybe they put it in a different barrel sometimes or something. But the reason that craft beer exploded in America is not because they were making the same thing all the time that sold well, that was just the regular run-of-the-mill product. They did cool, interesting things or tapped into history to do historical things. So, I think we do get a little surprised sometimes that we're in Georgia. Certainly when we, the only other distillery that did, that was kind of on par with us in the San Francisco World Spirits Competition was Balcones in Texas. Chattanooga did pretty well as well, but for the most part, we were in the top, at the very top, so I think probably people look at that and say, what, where? You know, it's people are used to that happening in San Francisco and Portland and Seattle, New York, and now in Atlanta.
This brings us to the end of this, our interview. Since we started doing this show, I've just been so happily surprised and astounded by how giving everyone is.
Oh, yeah. Just amazing generosity from folks. And I mean, you know, like they're trying to sell some whiskey, probably. But also, oh, man, just the fact that people who make cool stuff are willing to sit down and talk to us about it. I'm always just like, what? Me?
Yeah. And they're so passionate about it. They're just, I love it because if you didn't know, if you couldn't tell, we're a little nerdy. We like some science and some history, and I love that people we talk to just sprout out with them. They're like, we don't want to bore you. I'm like, no.
Please bore us.
We won't be bored at all.
Oh, that's the better response, yes.
Go into every detail ever. it was such a fun time, and I'm really glad that we got to do it and we got to share it with you.
Yes, absolutely. We hope that you enjoyed it as well. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do that thing.
There are a number of ways. One is email. You can email us at hello@savorpod.com.
You can also reach out on social media. We are @SavorPod on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We do hope to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thank you, too, for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.